Due to the graphic nature of some of the content for this episode, listener discretion is advised. The pursuit of truth is often a struggle, so you should expect to encounter all kinds of obstacles, deception and evasion, rabbit trails that don't lead anywhere. Still, I've come to believe that the greatest impediment to fact is not fiction, but rather perspective. Through the haze of our own experience, we are often left blinded to reality. Sometimes, to the point where we could be looking truth dead on and never really see it. My name is Freddie, and this is Unforgotten, a podcast that fumbles through the darkness, grasping for the who and why of a single event, the unsolved murder of Matt Stewart. In the last two episodes, we spoke with friends, family, and neighbors of Matt. We heard their experiences living through this nightmare, and we picked up key insight along the way. We also talked with several reporters who have worked to keep this bizarre case alive over the years. If you haven't listened to the first two episodes yet, I suggest you do that before going any further. Pastor Byron Wicker was, and still is, the lead pastor at River Life Fellowship, where Matt was a prominent member. Pastor Wicker had been a close mentor to Matt. He even gave the eulogy at Matt's funeral. Here are clips from a conversation I had with Pastor Wicker a few months back.
Matt was like a spiritual son to me. Coming to the church as a guy who'd grown up in the church, been saved, had fallen away, and I discipled him, and I had a close spiritual father, spiritual son relationship, like a Paul Timothy kind of thing. He would be the last guy on earth I'd think something like this would happen to.
In the wee hours of the morning with him.
Well, we got a phone call, like, in the middle of the night, and the phone call basically told us that Matt had been murdered. Angel had been shot. We weren't sure. We weren't sure about the children. I literally laid back down on my bed for a moment, hoping that I would wake up, and it was just a terrible, terrible dream. So we got up and went over to the house, attempted to go to the house, and of course the police stopped me. I told them who I was. The chief of police came over then, and he said, "Well, I can't let you in." He said, "But if you would like, we would love for you to pray." And so I can remember just sitting there praying, and please, Lord, yeah, because my mind is I'm going in there. If he's dead, I'm gonna pray the Lord to bring him back. Of course, that didn't happen. I never got the chance to go in there and pray for him. I knew Hannah had spent the night for the first time in her life with a friend, and then I found out that Naomi was safe. That the police had actually came in and got her out of there.
It was almost miraculous how Naomi was saved.
Yeah. She slept right through, and she was just, you know, across the hall, basically. It really looked like God put her into a deep sleep. And also the same thing with Hannah, because the first night she so happened to be spending the night with a friend, first time she's spent a night with a friend in her life. It was really was miraculous. After the police had finished with the house and finished all their crime scene investigation, they asked me if I'd be willing to go over and get Matt's stuff. They needed to get their stuff, because Angel was not going back in the house. I can remember walking into the house and thinking, my gosh, this is a peaceful Christian home. How could this happen in this home? And so I got the opportunity to work pretty close with the police. Like I kept telling them, I don't know if anybody would want to kill this guy. He's just not that kind of person.
There was like a serial killer in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Did they ever rule him out?
You know what? They never did rule him out. Okay, here's what the police told me. They told me that, one, they could not account for that guy's whereabouts, and he was in the area of Mooresville. They knew he was because of his job. They could never account for his whereabouts during the time Matt was murdered. He was killed in a shootout with the police later. However, they said the M.O. was different than the other murders. So they said they could not rule him out.
Did they give you any specifics about what they meant by the M.O. was different?
The other people, it was more like I know a couple of them, he had came in and held them at gunpoint, tied them up, shot them, that kind of thing. where Matt, this was like a brutal murder. I mean, Matt was, he was shot with different caliber guns, so there's more than one weapon involved. You know, some of the gun, you know, from the shells they pulled out of the walls of the house. There was also blunt force, so he was hit with something. It was according to what the police told me, you know, they wound up in the bathroom, Matt and this guy who killed him, and it was like a big fight in there. And they said there was blood everywhere. The whole walls were covered in blood. Even the blinds on the window had blood on them. When I was cleaning his stuff out from under the sink, you know, all his personal stuff, and I kind of glanced up, and on the ledge of the sink, you could see bloody fingerprints, like where he may have fell back and grabbed it. You know,
did the police lift prints off of?
They never said they never got any prints. And so that was the next crazy thing. Like, how could there be such a crazy crime scene and no real evidence left behind? It was like the person who did it was almost like they knew what they were doing. They said it's not random. They didn't believe, because they basically, in the police's eyes, random murders don't happen like this. It's kind of a mystery. It was a tense time, very intense.
Do you get any sense that there will be a resolution to his murder in terms of the perpetrator being brought to justice or exposed?
I can't say that I have a sense from the Holy Spirit that that's going to happen, but I have a hope that that will happen in the proper time and in the proper way. It could be very hard. That could create a hardship for everybody. Like opening up old wounds, that kind of thing. I have this hope in my heart that that will happen, that I'll see it happen. And honestly, my hope is whoever did it is no longer with us. The thought of having to go through a trial or something like that, to me, would be like, ooh, that would be very challenging for the family and for us. And we've prayed for the person who did it. We pray for them, like, God, mercy, have mercy, save the person, let the person confess. It was bloodshed. It was bloodshed, and it needs to be made right. I want the answer. I want to know what happened. I want to know why it happened. I mean, if you ever want to talk to anybody in the family, that some of them probably would not talk to you. But there's ones that may. I could probably tell you the angel probably would not do it. They talked to me about it, but they're a little jumpy. Like, I had a guy from the newspaper was wanting to speak with Angel, and I said, well, I'll ask her for you just out of respect to you, but I can tell you what her answer is going to be. It's going to be no. It's always going to be no. They haven't let it go. It's a cold case to them, but it's definitely still an active case to them. But, you know, I don't know how active.
Because the investigation is ongoing, all sorts of data collected from the crime scene, like photos, ballistics report, physical evidence, are all being kept in a file somewhere. What's in that file could likely tell us a lot more about what transpired on Shepherd's Hill Drive that night and give us some insight into who could have perpetrated this attack. So not having those documents can feel frustrating. But we also have to recognize the possibility that if certain information were to be made public, it could hinder the investigation's chances of finding Matt's killer. It could also hinder the chances of a court eventually convicting the killer if this is ever brought to trial. All that said, some documents from this crime are available to the public upon request, including the autopsy and medical examiner's report. The autopsy is 11 pages long and filled with distinctions and measurements for which I have absolutely no reference. It details the injuries Matt sustained, a series of stab wounds, gunshot wounds at various distances, and blunt force trauma. The first thing that jumped out at me was the specification of two different kinds of bullets, both large and medium caliber. This made me think back to what Pastor Wicker had suggested, that two guns may have been used to murder Matt. Again, I'm no expert, and I knew that if I really wanted to grasp what's in these reports, I needed to find someone who was. Dr. Carol Lieberman is no stranger to analyzing homicides. She's a nationally renowned forensic psychiatrist who has provided expert testimony for several high-profile murder cases. In 1992, her expertise was actually sought after by the United States Congress, and she appeared before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. Dr. Lieberman was kind enough to volunteer hours of her time to dig into this case. I sent her the autopsy and medical examiner's report, but also included audio files of interviews I had conducted, as well as other links to articles and outside research.
My name is Dr. Carol Lieberman. I'm a forensic psychiatrist, and expert witness in Beverly Hills. I actually trained in forensic psychiatry at NYU Bellevue, where a lot of the famous cases are brought. I've been doing this for over 20 years, hundreds of cases, criminal cases and civil cases nationwide, some very high-profile ones, like starting out with Jenny Jones' talk show murder. That was my first high-profile trial. It's fascinating to do expert witness cases, especially criminal cases, because it's like a treasure hunt in a sense. It's, you know, there's the, you want to get to the truth, and sometimes the truth is buried deeply. And the way that I work, of course, is examining, first of all, reading all the records that there is for a case, police reports, autopsy reports, interviews. Sometimes there are audio or video interviews by the police, let's say, of someone who's being questioned for a crime. So this story of Matt is a fascinating one in terms of, from all of the materials that you sent me about him and the pictures and the stories that some of the recordings that people you interviewed when they talk about him, you know, clearly he was a very well-meaning guy who devoted himself to children in particular. And so for him to have been murdered and for it to be a cold case seems particularly unfair.
And I know, looking at your resume, you've worked on quite a few interesting cases. So I was curious as to how it stacked up in terms of other cases kind of similar that you may have worked with, kind of home invasions.
There are a lot of unique things about this case. It was personal. There was an intruder who was just trying to steal something in the house, and of course nothing was stolen, but an intruder who didn't know them, didn't know him, didn't have some kind of personal connection, would not have done overkill. I mean, was dead before all of these wounds were inflicted, whether the gunshots or the stab wounds or the blunt trauma. I mean, it was overkill.
To play devil's advocate, you know, what I've heard it said or speculated that perhaps the person who perpetrated this was high. Do you have any experience in drug killings where someone is an addict and maybe not in their right mind? Is there any way, there be any way to explain if it wasn't a crime of passion, like a crime of desperate or momentary insanity?
Yes, when people are high, they have more strength and so on, but that doesn't really explain this kind of a stabbing and the shooting and that blunt trauma. And it was everything but the kitchen sink. So, and if it was someone who was high and maybe was looking for drug money, and they wouldn't have spent this much time killing the person. Yes, it could have been a little erratic, but not all of this time if the point was to just steal some things that they could sell for drugs or steal money or something. They didn't have to do overkill. It was like the person was thoroughly enjoying all of the violence that they were inflicting on Matt.
Basically, what you're saying is you're more or less convinced this wasn't a random...
Yes, absolutely. It wasn't like for a purpose of just killing someone. Why didn't this... If it was an intruder who didn't know Angel and was afraid of being identified at some later point, why would he have let her leave the house when he was over-killing Matt? Why would she have left with just a bullet in the wrist? And then, of course, how she left the house carrying the baby and leaving the other daughter, who was in one of the other bedrooms, just leaving her in the house and going out to the neighbor to call 911. No mother would have done that. She was obviously able to get out of the bedroom, which is totally questionable to begin with, but then why she didn't go to grab the daughter and run out of the house with her? Why would she leave? I mean, the maternal instinct should have kicked in.
You know, I've heard it said, well, you can't really know how someone would react in a severe, traumatic, you know, experience.
We're talking about maternal instinct. It's not something where you have to make a complicated plan. It would just be the normal reaction to save your daughter, to save all your children, when there's this madman in the house.
To get a better sense for what we can learn from the autopsy and medical examiner's report alone, I reached out to someone who is quite familiar with reading these kinds of documents, nationally renowned forensic pathologist Dr. Judy Melnick. Dr. Melnick's specialty is in wound interpretation and gunshot trajectory, which makes her analysis for this case extremely relevant. After publishing her memoirs, Dr. Melnick is now a best-selling author. The book is called Working Stiff, 2 Years, 262 Bodies, and the Making of a Medical Examiner. It documents Dr. Melnick's time in New York City in the early 2000s, and it includes some of her experiences working during the September 11th terrorist attacks. It's a really fascinating book, and I'd highly recommend you check it out. As you'll soon hear, compared to Dr. Lieberman, Dr. Melnick's take on the autopsy is quite a bit different. Keep in mind, these are highly trained experts, both working on a different set of expertise, and they're looking through different lenses.
My name is Judy Melnick. I'm a forensic pathologist. I have worked for 17 years in this field. I got my undergraduate degree at Harvard. I graduated magna cum laude, and then I went to medical school at UCLA, graduated in 1996, and then I did a fellowship training at the New York City Medical Examiner's Office, and I've been practicing in California, performing autopsies, doing death investigations, and also testifying in legal cases. Well, the first thing that I noticed was the ammunition that involved the recovery of this small pellet. It's described as a dense white plastic sphere. The reason it caught my eye is because what this is describing is something that sounds like Powerball ammunition. It's a partially jacketed bullet that has at its tip a plastic ball.
Does it do something distinctive?
Yeah, the advertising is that it doesn't snag on clothing or something like that, if I remember correctly. You'd have to look up their advertising. But it's rare. I don't see it very often. What's interesting about that is that it's an unusual enough type of ammunition that it wouldn't be difficult for a law enforcement agency to research where it's sold in the surrounding area during that time period. There is also the fact that there is both medium caliber and large caliber descriptions of the gunshot wounds. It indicates that if one gun is being used, there's two different types of ammo in it.
I was under the impression, because there was multiple calibers mentioned in the autopsy, that there would be multiple guns, but you're saying that it is possible one gun could have been used in multiple calibers.
It depends on the gun and the ammo, and I can't tell from this description. Again, there's no ballistics report associated with it. It's just a pathology report.
Matt's daughter said that he left a fourth of a fingerprint is all they could find.
Well, what's unusual about this is that you've got more than one implement. You've got sharp trauma and gunshot wounds. I mean, typically, if somebody's got a gun, they don't need a knife. They're just going to shoot you. So the fact that you've got both is rare. He put up quite a fight, and there are defensive injuries. I would find it unusual that there was absolutely no evidence at the scene. There's got to be something. It's just a question of having experienced homicide investigators or crime scene analysts look at the photos and look at the evidence that was collected. I mean, I've reviewed cases where people have given me the photos and it was a gunshot wound and they said, we never recovered the bullet. We took apart the bed. We took apart the bedding we thought would be in there and we couldn't find a bullet anywhere. And then I look at the photos and there's clearly a hole in the wall that they just missed, you know, because they were assuming that the person was by the bed when they were shot, when they were actually standing somewhere else and then went over to the bed later. So sometimes having an extra set of eyes looking at the scene photos helps identify evidence that wasn't recognized initially. That's what's hard when they shut down on a case and won't release information. You don't know who's looking at it. You don't know how many people have looked at it, and you don't know what level of expertise has been brought to it. I think it would be helpful to have crime scene analysts and other experts, maybe from an agency that's more comfortable and sees a lot more homicides, to weigh in and say, hey, why don't you test this or why don't you do this? They really need to, it's been 9 years. They need to either pass on the information to another agency that can get investigate further or look at things that they have missed. If they're actively investigating, they should be actively investigating. They should be interviewing people. They should be tracking down leads, doing testing. Crimes like these are usually solved within a year or two. But if they're not actively doing any more testing, and if nobody's actively looking at this case on a regular basis, they have to file it as a cold case, in which case they should be reaching out to the public. Like you are. You can't just keep that secret for 9 years.
I really agreed with what Dr. Melnick was saying here. 9 years is an awful long time to be holding on to something like this. If the case isn't going anywhere, investigators really need to release more information to the public or declare it a cold case and pass it on to a team especially trained in working cold cases.
I know you said you've worked like 12 homicides a year. I've heard other folks say that, you know, this was overkill. This was a particularly violent crime. Does that ring true to you looking at this?
No, I mean, I see lots of violent crimes. I mean, it's in the grand scheme of things. The only thing that's unusual, like I said, is the fact that you've got both a gun and a knife. Sometimes what will happen is a person will start off with a knife, and then when that doesn't work, then they will use a gun. But what's interesting in this case is that the wife was woken up by a gun going off. And I don't know if he was already struggling with the assailant before she woke up or before she got struck. You get a sense that there is different distances, you know, like I said, intermediate, close range, as well as distant range on the gunshot wound. Mm-hmm. So I've seen attacks like these on random strangers.
Really?
Some with home invasion components, usually to steal drugs or things like that. The reason you've got multiple wounds is because he's fighting. But here you've got multiple wounds which would not immediately incapacitate him. You know, the wounds to the abdomen, to the liver, to the chest, he could still continue to fight and struggle, and he would still be moving. So it's only the one that goes through the vertebrae that would drop him. And the same thing with the stab wounds. All of them are superficial except for the one at the temple. So that's at the end of the sequence. Whether that makes it a crime of passion, I don't know. I've seen this kind of spectrum of injury in people who put up a fight. And so the assailant just gets more and more aggressive and ratchets things up and uses more implements until the person's finally dead. It's not necessarily a crime of passion. It could just be a reaction to a person who's struggling and fighting.
Gotcha.
It's definitely not overkill.
Dr. Melnick's analysis of the nature of Matt's attack really surprised me. We've heard testimony in prior interviews stating that investigators became more or less convinced Matt's attacker was someone who knew him, that this murder was personal and not random. But what Dr. Melnick is telling us here is that from the autopsy and medical examiner's report alone, that truth is not evident to her, and her credentials speak for themselves. So maybe law enforcement's theory was derived from evidence not reported on in the autopsy, or from circumstances outside of the crime scene. Besides my interviews, another indication that law enforcement was focusing on the idea of a personal killing is found in the public statement issued by the Mooresville police chief just days after Matt's murder, in which he states that neighbors shouldn't be overly concerned, a likely signal that, at the time, they didn't perceive Matt's murder as a random home invasion. If there was a chance that a menace was on the loose targeting random victims, police would likely want folks to remain vigilant. A false sense of security could put people's lives in danger. But that's just an assumption. There were many times during the course of this that I felt disillusioned. I'd feel like I was headed in the right direction, only to end up where I started. But I kept at it. The more folks I talked with in the community, the more I heard about Matt's grandmother, his mother's mother, Jean. I wanted to learn more about what Jean's thoughts had been on the case before her passing in 2012. So I reached out to one of her family members, who was close to her up until her death. This person agreed to talk with me, under the condition that I not publicize their name. As an additional measure to seal their identity, I have altered the sound of their voice.
We were shocked. I mean, there's some things that has been said that it just don't make sense to me.
The case?
Yeah, about the case. And what puzzled me was his mother-in-law made the statement that she was en route up there when all this happened. And, well, the cops had the street blocked off, so she couldn't get in one way, so she went around. And she made the statement, she says, those cops wouldn't let me in, knowing that he was laying in there dying. I says, how did you know he was dying? Well, I would imagine. I mean, that's one statement that has stuck in my mind ever since it happened. He got mutilated that night, and it was the next day that she said that.
You're saying that when she got there, she already knew that he had been killed?
Her statement was this. The cops wouldn't let me in, so I went around the other way, knowing that Matt was in there dying. How did she know Matt was in there dying?
Did she say that someone had called to tell her that?
She didn't say. By the time he was buried, she goes up there, and she straightens the house up.
She went over to clean
after he was buried, she went over there to clean the house. She just goes up there by herself. Because I wanted to go over there myself. And no, nobody can go over there. But her mother went.
She was the only one that was allowed.
Yeah.
And it was to clean.
It was to clean.
I reached out to Matt's mother-in-law for comment, but she was unwilling to talk.
She said something about getting that, that show, America's Most Wanted, and they don't want to do that. And I find that kind of odd.
So Gene wanted America's Most Wanted to do a story on this?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask what you think Gene would think about what I'm trying to do with this podcast to get this story back out there.
She would be thrilled to this. Yeah, she would be thrilled.
Out of everyone I've talked with thus far, Pastor Wicker seems to have had the most involvement with investigators. And it sounds like that involvement still continues to this day.
Occasionally I run into the detective that works on the case. Like I run into him in a restaurant or something, and I'll have a little conversation with him. And just always about the case. Like, he'll ask me, do you know anything new? No. Do you know anything new? Of course they won't tell you. And I will tell you this. Certain people in the law enforcement community that believe it was a serial killer, but they would never publicly say that because they can't. They might say it off the record and hold, you know, like, don't you ever say I said it. Don't ever use my name in that.
Next month, we'll have more conversations with neighbors, this time in person, and we'll dive deeper into the crimes of the Gaffney serial killer as we inch closer towards the truth. Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida, with music and audio production by myself and the ever spectacular Matt Garrett. This episode is named after a song by my favorite musician, Gray Revell. Check it out wherever you stream or download music. Special thanks to Pastor Byron Wicker, Dr. Carol Lieberman, and Dr. Judy Melanick for their contributions to this episode. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.